Esports will be the globe's most popular sport. Yes, I said sport. By 2022. But to get there, a lot of deals need to be made and analyzed. We've got you covered. Today on Episode 1, we welcome to the pod one of the godfathers of esports, Craig Levine, current CEO of Turtle Entertainment America, aka ESL. Craig and I discuss his background in the space, the brewing live streaming war, the David Hill deal, IEM Katowice, VR, and much, much more. Straight out of Stamford, Connecticut, the city that works, I'm Mike Prindeville, and this is the Esports Exchange on NBC Sports. I'm here with Craig Levine, CEO at Turtle Entertainment America Incorporated, aka ESL, the Electronic Sports League. Craig, how are you today, my friend?
Doing well. Happy to be here.
Great. Great to have you. Thanks for coming. Psyched to have you as our first guest. You know, obviously you're a very influential guy in the space of esports. You're an influential guy. You helped, ease me into the space as well. So I kind of wanted to start today's discussion with sort of a big picture perspective of ESL. I mean, I know a lot of people in the space are very familiar with the company, but for those who aren't, sort of give me the background of Turtle Entertainment and ESL and how you guys got started and where you're at.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so unique. We just all grew up from a leadership perspective as gamers. So we grew up and organically wanted to sort of be playing with friends locally, seeing who's better on the internet. So out of that, from a leadership perspective, we started teams. And out of teams, we started competing against each other, and we said, hey, there should be a better run league. So we started doing these leagues, and we started wanting to play at these events. And the whole idea behind ESL really just sort of started out of necessity of needing to build this infrastructure that didn't exist in the late 90s as we all started playing internet-based games together.
Okay, so this is where it started. In the late 90s, you're saying, was this high school? Was this college for you?
So for me, this was high school.
Okay.
What
games were you playing?
Back then, it was Quake 2, Capture the Flag, Team Fortress Classic, Action Quake, and then eventually found my way into Counter-Strike, which for me was sort of where I've made my career, okay, for lack of a better word.
As a lot of people have. And so what was the first sort of personal venture that you had in the esports space? Was it starting a team?
Yeah, so in about 2002, I started a pro team called Team 3D. We kind of recruited the top talent. I was in college at the time. Loved playing games, quickly realized I wouldn't be able to have a social life and go to school and continue to put in the hours that I had. So kind of recruited some of the best players and took us an iteration or two to get through, but eventually became world championships. And for a series of about 5 years after, really were clearly the best team in North America and competing at a high level internationally, traveling around the world. So it's really where I got my first taste of esports.
That's amazing. So give people at home sort of a taste of like what type of revenue you were generating as a team at that time when you were so successful.
Yeah, I mean, it was a different world back then. There was before Facebook and YouTube and Twitch even. We would go to events and we'd put five in a hotel room and we'd be, carrying computers on luggage into airplanes through security. And competing in hotel ballrooms. So the business model back then was really sponsorship driven. And we had deals, we were fortunate at the time, early deals with CompUSA, eventually Intel and NVIDIA, and eventually the Subway restaurants and others that you kind of see in the world today, SteelSeries, Sennheiser, and so on. But those dollars back then, I think we were making $1,500 a month, probably salary at the time. Plus prize winnings, mm-hmm. And on good years we're probably in the 50K type of earnings, whereas today's top players are literally making seven figures.
Yeah, it's gotten crazy. So your role within 3D, you were the CEO. Were you the coach, the manager? Did you play as well?
Yeah, so it was all sort of a hybrid role. Mm-hmm. There wasn't the same sophistication of an organization that exists today. So I was the CEO, for lack of a better word, and also sort of the team manager. So ultimately making the calls on roster decisions, we bring in a coach, do we not? What events are we going to? The business dealings, negotiating player transfers, all those sorts of logistical elements.
And how many teams like 3D at that time were in this scene? How big was the scene?
The scene from a loosely professional organization was probably about 4 of them in North America, probably about 10 to 12 of them globally. And then obviously huge ranks of amateurs below. A lot of the events back then were more participatory, whereas today's big events are more sort of the culmination of months of online qualifiers. So the big events that we used to go to, then we'd, you know, be competing for 5 days and grinding it out through a 256 team bracket, much like you'd see in the World Series of Poker today.
And sort of describe, like, obviously Twitch wasn't around during that day, live stream wasn't around during that day. How did people get to know teams, and how did the teams sort of communicate amongst themselves? How did you find these events?
Yeah, so, you know, back then there was a big tool called IRC, or Internet Relay Chat. That's sort of where esports and gaming really grew out of. Each team would have their own channel in there, and you'd sort of build fan bases that would follow you through. Again, pre-Facebook, everyone had a website. You know, you'd have little fan sections in there, and that's sort of how the information in the community would kind of gather. And then there were, you know, a couple of predecessors to real social networks, one called SoGamed at the time. That was just sort of like the social network for gaming and esports that everyone would go to. And at events themselves, you'd either spectate the games if you couldn't make it on site through the in-game spectator client, much like what exists today. Mm-hmm. Or even what you do is you'd copy and paste a URL into Winamp, and you'd sort of get the play-by-play, which is where the term shoutcaster actually came from, sort of just like your first generation of radio broadcasters. So you try to sync up the Winamp link with your in-game view to kind of have that viewing experience from home.
That's amazing. And so tell me about your exit from 3D. How did it end, and then what was your next venture?
So in about 2007, there was an initiative from DirecTV called the Championship Gaming Series, sort of a big gaming project from News Corp. And they were looking to sort of build out teams based to different cities, and kind of made the decision at that point I'd focus more on the business side of it rather than the team side. Sold a team to News Corp at that point. We became 3D New York, only fitting. Didn't last long. The financial crisis came. They sort of shut it down. I reacquired the team at that point, but then out of that had just sort of been building, you know, more of the business and event infrastructure for what you see today in the U.S. specifically.
Right. So what the event infrastructure, which is obviously that's the business you're in today, sort of talk about how you sort of built that out during this time, and what the vision was maybe in the late, you know, 2008, 2009 category, and then sort of where you're at today.
Yeah, so I hosted just starting regional local competitions here in New York City. There was an internet cafe that we would host them at, and that kind of grew notoriety. We started hosting regional competitions. Those became national competitions, and eventually realized the opportunity was greater than that of the four walls that we had, sort of a brick-and-mortar location. So we left that company and started sort of an agency that started producing these all over. Mm-hmm. We would do everything from online qualifiers to what we're called bring your own computer, or BYOC events, and aircraft carriers, and kind of all over. And then with Championship Gaming Series is where we got our first exposure to the world of TV production. So for a couple of years, we produced, you know, 40 plus hours each year or each season of live competition on DirecTV. Mm-hmm. This is back in 2008. So it was back on the 101, and you know, we kind of got exposed, I think, to a much different world, which then has been the basis, I think, for where we've evolved things out of from there. We'd kind of consolidated institutional investors, former founders, and active management, and with that, they'd acquired 74%, and the balance still sits with active management today. So they've been great partners for us. They've helped us grow up the business, add some sophistication. And I think together try to find ways to do more in esports. And through that, you know, they've also identified the fragmented nature, and have had some consolidation and roll up through the industry as well, acquiring DreamHack, acquiring ESEA, and some different regional esports players to ultimately build a global footprint.
Give an idea of how many events you guys do a year, just how busy you guys are as a leading event organizer in this space.
Yeah, so what's great about ESL is we have the opportunity to work with all different games and all different platforms. I think that's part of what makes us as a company so unique. Mm-hmm. You know, that we're able to feed amateur, professional competition sort of all year long. With that, we're hosting competitions all the time. So we probably do about 300 production days a year out of our studio in Burbank. So pretty busy. We do three big sort of arenas or large theater events this year in North America. We'll do New York, Bay Area, and then our Dallas, Texas this year with our Counter-Strike Pro League finals. And then we have footprints typically at some of the different big trade shows like E3 and so on. And then periodically throughout the year, we're hosting live events with fans at our studio, hosting remote broad competitions at different events or theaters. So generally speaking, there's no rest for the wicked.
Very busy man, that's for sure. So looking forward, you know, your crystal ball the next 5 or 10 years, what do you see as like some of the biggest challenges that ESL faces, especially as we see, you know, publishers becoming a little bit more controlling with their IP in the space? What's ESL's big plan?
Yeah, I think ultimately it's going to start to shake out over the next, I think, 2 or 3 years. I think right now everyone's still trying to understand what esports is and what it means for their business. You know, we've been doing this for ESL was founded in 2001. Mm. So we had a very lonely pool party for a very long time. And the last 3 years, we've started, you know, the industry as a whole is starting to get a lot of attention there. So with that, I think there's a lot of outside investment. There's a lot of esports finds itself as sort of the middle point of more macro entertainment changes that are going on, cultural changes, digital changes. So I think esports sort of starts to check a lot of those boxes and is the first form to really embrace it all as what we call the sport of a digital generation now. So for ESL, it's continuing to sort of work closely with our publishing partners who are our biggest partners and help them kind of navigate what this means for them. And every publisher's got a different strategy. Some of them do a lot on their own. Some of them do all on their own. Some of them tap us to help with it. Some of us leave it to us to do our own thing. I think ultimately over the next few years, you're going to see the business of esports become much more defined. And with that, I think it's become easier to sort of structure those frameworks for what a business relationship is with these IP holders. But between here and there, I think there's a lot of feeling out that everyone's still got to do to really understand what esports means for their business, whether it's just marketing of the game or whether it really is big enough to be monetized, you know, with what you see with League of Legends and Counter-Strike and other massive games today.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you've mentioned a number of deals recently that that ESL has either got in on or partnered with, and you know, I want to talk a little bit about live streaming within esports. Obviously, it's a digital first industry. Live streaming is very core, but there's been some really interesting deals announced in particular with ESL recently. The first one that comes to mind was the deal with Twitter. You guys in DreamHack recently announced you know, a partnership with the social media giant where you're going to broadcast non-exclusively, right? More than 15 events, including DreamHack and some of the IEMs. And then you're going to have this exclusive 30-minute weekly esports show. It's a big deal. Why don't you talk to me about, like, what prompted this deal and why Twitter?
Yeah, so I think for ESL and esports as a whole even, it's still very nascent. As much as everyone wants to think that we've arrived, we still need to build more fans. So for us, one of the key strategies is extending reach and relevance. And to do that, it's finding distribution partners that could help unlock new audiences. So obviously we've been, you know, we've been built up on Twitch, and then over the years have added, you know, different partnerships with YouTube and Azubu and Hitbox and Yahoo and so on. But the relationship now with Twitter is there's an increased emphasis on their business with live streaming, we think is incredibly exciting for us to start to open up new audiences to esports, start to create content specifically for that platform, and most importantly, provide a very natural and organic way where our audience already is. They are very heavy Twitter users and Twitter followers, and being able to, you know, serve them through that, I think is really important for us.
So one of the premier events for ESL is IEM Katowice, and that was also recently was live streamed on Twitter. So what was the feedback like around that on events, specifically on for the people who watched on Twitter?
Yeah, I think the feedback was really positive. You know, it's sort of their first endeavor into esports, our first endeavor onto Twitter. So there's always sort of key learnings that come out of that. But generally speaking, it really, we thought, amplified and extended the audience that we would otherwise reach. And I think in total, we had something like 46 million unique viewers over the course of our event. So You know, the strategy of increased distribution to increase reach with the right partners, I think is starting to work. And to your point earlier, really trying to find ways to create exclusive components around that, like the Esports Weekly show, that then they could become more of a destination based within the audience as well.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about that show.
Yeah, so we had our first show right after, you know, the live competition in Katowice. So it's, you know, a weekly show that'll be put out now, sort of capturing all the happenings in esports. And much like any content, I'd imagine we're going to sort of find our voice over time based on feedback from the community. So we'll just continue to iterate off that. But certainly a very encouraging first jump off for us.
I am interested in the decision, you know, to create a show around esports versus to create one just focusing specifically on one particular game, like a CSGO. Sort of what was the thought process or debate internally at ESL?
I think it's still about, you know, again, finding our voice and serving the community. And we think there's an opportunity to sort of highlight all of the great things that are going on across multiple titles. I think we've seen that be very successful with traditional sports, you know, with a lot of sort of the general, you know, programming that's out there for that. So, you know, it's something, again, we'll experiment with. I think if we can make the voice loud enough, or sorry, if we could, you know, aggregate the audience in the right way, that this would, you know, become one of many different types of shows. And we would imagine that there are programming opportunities specific for certain games on a regular basis. But we also think the ability to cross-pollinate genres will ultimately grow the pot for everyone, again, which for us right now is still a key strategy.
Million-dollar question, Craig. We're sitting here talking about Twitter. We know that, you know, Twitter, along with Twitch, is a huge home for gamers. Everybody seems to be on Twitter except for you. Please, inquiring minds want to know, what's the deal?
I think only bad things will come out of going on social media.
Okay.
So I've, you know, we've got a good public, channel out there for a lot of our PR messages. And then, you know, I've got to grace wonderful people like you with these podcasts, to really hear what's going on in my head. So,
if people want to contact you directly, it's either snail mail or through me.
Through you. Okay. Preferably through you.
Okay, great. Send them my way, folks.
They can tweet at you.
That's right. Tweet at me. At Mike Prindy, and then just hashtag Craig, and then I'll get it right to them, I promise.
See if we can get it trending.
Okay, so another big deal in the live streaming space you guys recently did was with YouTube Gaming, right? And it was the decision to go exclusive with YouTube Gaming, I believe, for the ESL Pro League. Is that right?
Yep, our Counter-Strike Pro League.
Okay. And so sort of tell me about the decision to go exclusive in that instance and sort of what around a property are the deciding factors where you would go exclusive instead of non-exclusive and just trying to put it as many places as you can.
Yeah, so we're trying to figure out sort of the monetization behind it, and trying to experiment. And I think that's what we've done so well as ESL, I think, is, you know, take some risks that I think are hard to take out there. So we felt that Counter-Strike being such a global game because of the unique business partnership with the teams that are participating with our Counter-Strike Pro Leagues, that we'd have the opportunity to leverage them to ultimately drive destination-based viewing. And obviously, you know, YouTube is still a massive platform. I think 350 million unique gaming, you know, eyeballs are reaching that on a monthly basis. So we kind of thought that if there was one that would make sense, it would be YouTube. And we've had a very successful launch through the first few weeks on there. You know, obviously with any new platform change, there's an education period. Mm-hmm. But we've been able to sort of achieve increased...
Educating people to... how to find YouTube.
Educating people how to find the CSGO Pro League now.
There you go.
And through that, you know, I've been able to get more eyeballs on our content. So right. We've actually seen increased viewership over the first few weeks. And obviously still leverage Twitch and other platforms for local language streams, for reruns, and so on. But for us, it was sort of that first stab of trying to see, really try to measure the type of power that we think some of this content really can deliver.
So the war sort of going on within the live stream world, we've got Twitch, we've got YouTube, it's been heating up for some time. Obviously, Twitter's getting in the game, right? We've got Riot's deal recently with MLBAM.
Facebook.
We've got Facebook. Activision Blizzard is streaming on Facebook, has exclusive rights to Heroes of the Dorm, right? So, you know, how do you see this all netting out?
I think it's going to take time still. I think what you've seen now is sort of a new generation of digital distribution, right, sort of the 2.0, if you will, from some of the more, you know, grassroots ones that had formed up in the past. And I think that only speaks to the growing direction of digital entertainment. So it's big business. A lot of these guys have big things at stake, NBC and other traditional media companies trying to figure out how to make that transformation. And I think ultimately it's going to come down to, you know, there's just some pretty formidable competitors. And for us as content creators, you know, we've sort of made that decision of not creating distribution, but rather leveraging that of partners to increase reach. So again, as we look at all of those different partners and the collective billions of eyeballs that they reach, we see that as a way to distribute our content and get more people into it. Ultimately, we believe different content will live best on different platforms. It's going to take a couple of iterations through this to figure out what works, but the same way what would work on linear might be different on digital, or how someone consumes something on Netflix is different than how you watch it on YouTube. So all of those things are just the experiments that as an industry we've got to go through over the next few years.
We talked about digital. Now let's talk a little bit about linear. Another recent story in the news, obviously, was that ESL went out and you guys hired David Hill, the former Fox executive, the guy who started Fox Sports One, I believe. And you know, he was brought in to help you guys. The quote in the news, right, was to provide your events with television-style production values. What do you guys mean by that?
So, you know, we had the opportunity to work with David, really try to figure out how to take our productions to the next level. We've been serving a core audience for a long time, and I think we're starting to fine-tune what that means for them. But a goal of ours is to broaden that up, and that doesn't have to be and shouldn't be mutually exclusive or at the expense of our core. But we'd be naive to think that we know everything about broadcast or about entertainment. So David brings an incredible amount of insight and, more importantly, brings a real appreciation for the athletes and the competition. So for us, that was incredibly important, was sort of having someone come in with his experience, with his background, but also with a real open mind to sort of learn our world within it. So it's been he's an incredible character, and we've really enjoyed the opportunity to work together thus far.
That's great. So are there particular sort of positions within a broadcast that he's identified as wanting to level up?
Yes, I think we're sort of starting at the basics of this and sort of building off from there. We're not pretending to have all the right answers. So a big focus of ours actually is talent. You know, he's built some of the most legendary voices in sports today, and sort of creating an official program that our talent can go through to professionalize themselves and further their craft, we think is a great value and opportunity for those guys. So much of the talent that you see in esports had been ex-players or influencers or streamers, but there really is an art and a science to it. So that's something that he's really spending some time with us to figure out how we teach that. So that's one of the first priorities.
Is that all going to be taught to existing casters, or is there an idea here that there might be a broadcaster within the sports world who could cross over into esports?
I think we're open to both, to be frank. I think the play-by-play guys are probably require such a deep depth of knowledge that it's got to be endemic. But we've done some great stuff with OJ Bourne, who was a BBC personality, who's now hosted major events for us in Counter-Strike and other games, and is so widely accepted from the community. He's part of it. So I think that's the perfect example of where we've taken a traditional talent and sort of integrated them into our world, and it's worked really well. So I don't think we're closed-minded to what that looks like, but there's a great deal of talent out there from the world of esports, and you know, hopefully if we could add some coaching to that, we could just continue to elevate the product for everyone.
Talk about just the general challenges around producing an esports live production versus like what you would think or what is commonly known within a traditional sports production.
I think the biggest challenge from an esports production is you go, you know, you turn on the cameras for a football game or a soccer game or a basketball game. The court's there. The court's there every day. You know, we come into town, we're sort of building the circus and everything that goes around it. It's an incredibly technical environment from a PC or console. Obviously, all the AV equipment. So it starts to just add a lot of technical complexity to it, and that takes time. So that's certainly one of the challenges that we face with it. And then also, how do you extract personality, right, in storytelling in a world where so much of the content is in-game and virtual personas, trying to capture that personality and bring it out from them. And you only have a few moments to do that. Entrances or emotional shots and player cams. So you've really got to kind of pick and choose the way to do that. You know, ultimately, we're big believers that any sport is about stars, and esports has them out there. You know, we've just got to find a way to shine the light on them in the right way.
So is the overall sort of play here, is it more about increasing the production value of all esports events, or is it more about the ones that are going to have this linear TV component bringing them to a higher level?
It's both. I think, you know, the idea of, we're not building something specific for linear. I think we're building something for where our audience is asking us to go. And when you watch, you know, if we're with the viewership that we're getting and the spectacle that we're creating, there's more pressure in a good way to sort of up level, you know, our ability to sort of tell that story over an event or a weekend or a match. So we're looking at it, everything from our daily shows that are going on from our studios. How do we do a better job at that? All the way up to these big events that are, you know, the world's best gamers on the world's biggest stage. We think there's an appetite from the audience to see that. And then with the convergence of digital and linear and OTT and everything going on, just the expectation is higher. So we want to have a product that's linear ready, sort of representing the highest level of production standards that then meets the needs of different digital or partners in different distribution points.
In esports, obviously, you know, digital first. Now we're seeing a lot of linear TV come into the fold. Like, where does television as a medium sort of sit in the scale of importance of esports?
I think there's a few years period where we all kind of need each other. I think as big traditional companies are trying to go digital, and esports is still trying to break through for more mainstream and widespread credibility and validation, TV still offers that. There's an incredible power behind it. So I think over these next few years together, how we could help be partnering content and partners for big traditional companies to transition an audience to linear. So we're believers that linear has a huge role in it to, again, build more fans. But most interestingly is to do it with a strategy behind it. We don't think that's done with a one-off. We think there's opportunities to cross-program, to drive people to digital. And I think ultimately, you know, those that have the appetite to sort of take a big bite in that way are the ones that are going to be successful. I think what we've seen outside of Turner have been lots of little bets or lots of little steps. I don't know that any of them have really even yielded that meaningful of an insight to even measure against. Mm-hmm. I think it's just going to take a little bit more time for everyone to understand it and get comfortable. But we're certainly out there trying to lead that conversation.
So I want to go through a couple other smaller stories that have been out there recently, topics of interest, before we close things up here. We were talking about Katowice earlier. It's obviously a huge spectacle. Can you give the people at home an idea of just how big it is?
I've been in esports for 18 years now. When I first went to Katowice three years ago, it was the first Goosebumps moments I've had outside of Asia. We had 173,000 people attending. We had the arena and the adjacent expo hall packed with side games, with booths. We had Gillette activating. We had Sprite in there. We had all these great partnerships. And, you know, the Intel Extreme Masters is the world's longest running real esports circuit at this point. Mm-hmm. So playing in front of, for any competitor to play in front of a crowd like that is ultimately what it's about in any sport. And I think we received such positive feedback from the players because of the crowds that we're able to kind of, you know, cultivate there. So it really is sort of the Super Bowl of esports. It brings together gamers from different genres. We had League of Legends and StarCraft and Counter-Strike and Heroes of the Storm and Crossfire and all of these different titles sort of going on there that I think there's something for everyone. So it's just such a special event and really brings people of a certain culture together to celebrate that, which is really what we're trying to build with these.
When people think about massive esports crowds, right, they think South Korea, they think China, they think Greater Asia, right? You know, they think League of Legends, wherever they are, basically. Poland. How did you guys know to go there? How did you guys sort of uncork that as being this Super Bowl of esports?
It's an incredibly quickly developing economy, growing middle class, growing disposable income, passionate community of gamers there. So there was an endemic audience there. And, you know, our local team there was able to tap local government support for our event. So, you know, deals with the arena, deals for promotion, sort of things that helped de-risk it. In the first year, 5 years ago, when we did this event, it was the first real stadium event outside of Asia. It had never been done. We didn't know if it would work. And I think over that time, the city of Katowice was trying to transform itself into a younger digital sort of hub. And they've successfully been able to do that, I think, you know, with partnership to the Intel Extreme Masters and the events that we've created there. So we've sort of put them on the map. They've been a great host for us, but it's a great case study, I think, of how we worked hand in hand with a city to really build something that stands out.
Do you wonder about the sustainability of the League of Legends portion of this event?
Yeah, I mean, we've got to find ways to continue to be relevant, right? It's a the LCS is an incredible ecosystem that they've created there. We're fortunate to have been partners with them early on and help build their esports program, you know, to the point that we see today. So, you know, we're incredibly gracious and thankful for the opportunity that Intel Extreme Masters is able to feature League of Legends teams. And obviously there's certain scheduling constraints that we try to do it with within, but we've got to find ways to be relevant and we've got to make sure that our events have real meaning. And there's different ways that could happen, right? Is that the biggest prize money in the world? Is it the biggest stage in the world? Is it the players tournament with the best conditions to it all? These are all sort of product visions that we work to define. But, you know, we're thankful for the opportunity with League of Legends. We think it's an incredible game. Our fan base and community loves it. So we want to continue to, you know, iterate on it and do good things around it to make sure that we've got a place in the in that community.
Yeah, it's a fantastic event. So hope that happens. Let's talk about the future of esports, starting with mobile. Everybody loves to talk about mobile esports. Vainglory, sort of like the default leader in that space. Now we see Clash Royale announcing this 2v2 clan mode. Are you excited for this space?
Yeah, I think, you know, with most technologies, it takes longer than everyone thinks to catch on, right? The first iPhone came out in 2007 or 2008. Everyone thought mobile was there, mobile esports. And in my mind, it was really Clash Royale, I think, that sort of breaking through it. Obviously, Vainglory has led the charge. Hearthstone, you know, is really a cross-platform product. But I think, in my mind, Clash Royale has the opportunity to really help break through the next steps to it. So it's funny. At the highest level, we're all fans of the game. I mean, I probably play literally 2 hours a day. I don't want to say how much I've spent. But I think it just proves to it how much there's sticky content. And just about creating the right interface and experience for the device and the content around it. And I think that's what Clash did so well, was it made it real time. It's not turn-based. So it really embraced that PvP component to it, the competitive spirit. Tons of skill and strategy goes into it. It's quick. It's fast-paced. So it's fun. So I think Clash has a real upside to it. And I think will really inspire sort of the next generation of mobile esports to lead the way through it.
What does ESL have in the pipeline for mobile?
We continue to work with a lot of different titles. So, you know, if you look at where we started working with PC game publishers and developers years ago, sort of there's a learning curve that everyone goes through. Mm-hmm. So we're early on that, working with, you know, lots of different publishers, though, to try to experiment, do things that are, you know, appropriate to it. And, you know, until they really, really understand what esports can mean for their business and their community, it's just going to take a little bit of time to get through. But there's a lot of interest in the platform. Will it ever replace, you know, the mouse and keyboard? No, but it's a different kind of competition, right? The same way there's Formula One racing and there's stock car racing. There's something for everyone. I think that's what's so great about esports. It's not one size fits all.
Yeah, you mentioned being out front. ESL is frequently out front of a lot of things, and VR is one of them. I think you guys partnered with, was it Sliver.tv?
Yep.
And how did that come off? Describe that sort of event. That was a first in the space.
Yeah, so ESL One New York last year was from the Barclays Center. It was the first time, I think, that we'd live streamed sort of an event in VR. And it was great. You know, obviously, they're still early in the technology. But we believe that our content and our audience is uniquely positioned to really sort of be the early adopters to it. All of our content's digital. You know, it's typically a PC first kind of experience on VR right now, which is the native platform for a lot of our users. So it's going to early on, we believe the strategy with VR is about much like other sports is content and access. So if we could put you inside the huddle, if we could put you inside the event, we think that's a unique experience for a fan. And over time, you know, fully we expect it's going to take a long time. You know, the ability to ultimately be competing in virtual reality games as esports competitions is only inevitable.
Yeah. So there will be a point in time where we can watch and actually be in, feel like we're in the game.
Yeah, and we're doing that right now with our events. You could kind of go in and you're literally inside the Counter-Strike universe, inside, you know, Dust 2. And sort of seeing what's going on and able to look up and see the program feed or look left and see, you know, a real-time battle between two players. So the technology's getting there, but it's still very early.
That's great. Well, Craig Levine, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, the first, the inaugural eSports. It's
quite an honor. Thanks for having me.
Yes, yes. I hope you guys enjoyed listening to this. I enjoyed recording it. I enjoyed seeing Craig. He's a handsome man. If you did enjoy, please make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a rating if you feel so inclined. Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever podcasts can be found. Send me comments, questions, ideas. I'm at Mike on Twitter. Craig?
Hashtag Craig at Mike Prindy.
Yes, hashtag Craig. Let's get that trending. See you guys next week.